I've been loving you.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee this week. Today, our show is dedicated to music born in Macon. Artists like Otis Redding, the Allman Brothers, and Little Richard all got their start in Middle Georgia. We're going to talk about the people and the events that have made Macon a musical mainstay in Southern culture. But we want to know from you, who is your favorite artist from Macon? Do you have a favorite song that you'd like to share? If you do, call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. And feel free to sing along a little bit. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, if Aretha Franklin is the queen of soul, Otis Redding was the king. Had he lived, Otis would have turned 75 this month. He was only 26 years old when he died in a plane crash in 1967. This past weekend, Macon hosted a festival to honor the soul singer, which included a performance by his two sons. Mark Hrabowski is the author of Dreams to Remember, Otis Redding, Stax Records, and the Transformation of American Soul. Celeste Headlee spoke with him last year when his book first came out. She began the conversation by asking Mark what Redding's career might have been if he had lived past his mid-20s.
This is, of course, the million-dollar question that we'll never know. We'll never know it about people like that, like Hank Williams and the Lynyrd Skynyrd and Patsy Cline. We just don't know, okay? He was 26, which leads you to believe he had another good two decades left of being an influence, being a mover in the industry. I think he would have probably gone into the production end, but still would have retained, the performing aspect, because that was who he was, turning himself inside out when he sang. But he was a man of great ambition. And a lot of people didn't realize that when he died, it was actually at a crossroads of his career. The suspicion was he would have left Stax and gone to Atlantic and had a whole different phase to his career. So we really don't know. We just have to enjoy all the living he did pack into those years.
You know, it's interesting that you mention his work as a producer, because I think many people don't know about that. And it was a revelation to me to read about that in your book. Can you tell me a little bit about what he was like as a producer? Let me use his own quote here. He was talking about the recording of Respect.
Right.
And he said at one point, it took me a whole day to write it, 20 minutes to arrange it. We cut it once and that was it. What was he like as a producer?
Yeah, well, that's because that was the whole Stax thing. It was so different from even Motown, which started in the same humble, humble origins of Stax. But Motown was a very high production, high tech operation. Stax is sort of like a Stone Age operation, but it was perfect for a guy from the Georgia backwoods like Otis, who could just come in and let it fly and record two or three or four songs in a couple hours and be gone. And the songs would be perfect. It was like a perfect storm, and it really reached its fruition when Otis came along in 1962. And that he virtually carried it on his back from then on. That's how he produced.
Let's hear, actually, a little bit of that song, Respect.
What you want, honey, you got it. And what you need, baby, you got it. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
So you're talking about Stax Records, and I wondered how much of it was kismet, because in the collaboration between Stax, Volt, and Atlantic Records, they had 167 songs that made the top 100 on the pop chart, 250 songs in the R&B chart, and that's in a relatively short period of time. Did they just get lucky, or were there some smart people who recognized talent when they saw it?
Well, it's always a matter of luck. Even in Motown with Berry Gordy, it was a matter of luck. It was a very slow start, and then people started coming on, like the Supremes and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder. And then when Otis came on, it was, like you say, kismet, because he really focalized everything that they wanted to do there. They wanted to keep it very simple. They didn't want to. They always had the vocals recorded at the same time as the instrumental, There was no instrumental track because everything was like done like it was in a club, like an R&B club.
Yeah.
He'd come in, he'd sing, they'd play. A lot of the time by instinct alone, which is an amazing thing when you consider these great songs. It was never laid out in arrangements on charts. So he really focalized this because he was able to do it so perfectly.
So let's hear Otis Redding's very first single. This is These Arms of Mine. Take a listen.
These arms of mine, they
we hear that now and we've heard it for 50 years, more than 50 years, and it may not sound revolutionary, but at the time, this really hit struck people's ears as something, a very different sound. What are we hearing here that made Otis Redding so different from so many of his contemporaries?
Well, you see, this is the perfect example of the simplicity and from the gut, not from the mixing board. How many songs are an audition tape that become a song that's released in a couple of weeks and becomes a hit? That was actually Otis's audition tape at Stax, when he didn't even know he was going to have an audition, because he came up as the driver for another guy who was having an audition, Johnny Jenkins, in whose band he played at the time in Macon. He didn't know he was going to be recording for Stax Records, and they put him in front of a microphone, and that's what you got from Otis. It was always the same. It would come from the heart and the soul, and he would knock you out when he did that.
So if you're out there listening and you're an Otis Redding fan, we want to know, what is your favorite Otis Redding song? Dave Zirin writes, so many best songs, but the best moment is that pause after I've Been on I've Been Loving You Too Long. And then S.C. Josen says, I've Been Loving You Too Long and A Change Is Gonna Come, Can't Decide. So let's take a listen to A Change Is Gonna Come. This was originally sung by Sam Cooke, but here is Otis's rendition. I get chills when I hear that, but how did he distinguish himself from, say, a Sam Cooke, who also did that song beautifully? What was Otis's personal touch on this music?
I think it was the fact that when he did another person's song, he would cover them. It sounded nothing like the original. It sounded absolutely nothing like Sam Cooke. When he did Satisfaction, it sounded absolutely nothing like the Stones. That was his gift, being able to take any song. Bob Dylan wanted him to do a song, you know. He wanted, just like a woman, okay? He wanted Otis Redding to do that song. And Otis actually had a crack at recording it, but couldn't get the intricate lyrics, couldn't really get it down, and wound up not doing it. But that's just an example of all of these people, these powerful influences in music, who would have died if Otis could have recorded one of their songs.
Well, one of the things you point out is that he could not read music, and you describe how that affected the way that he both wrote and recorded. How was that?
Well, he recorded. He had everything in his head. He was one of those few people who could write a song in his head and come into the studio and have it all arranged in his head. And he would play a guitar in the studio. He wasn't a musician, but he came in with this old guitar, and he would know how to just play the basic chords, and from that, it would start falling into place. The horns would start falling into place. The bass line would fall into place. Steve Cropper would add that little saucy seasoning at the end on the electric guitar. And that's how it would all form together out of what was in Otis's head. I don't think I've ever come across anybody. I've written a lot of music books. I don't think there was ever anybody who came in with a song perfectly formed in his head the way Otis did.
So then that brings us to the song, and he still holds the record as the only person to hit the pop charts with a song after his death. He died in 1967, and after that, this song was released, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in. Then I watch them roll away again, yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
This is a song, Mark, that many people point to as having been influential. Why? What is so influential about this song? Why does it have such impact?
Because it was completely against type. It was proof that Otis could take a song and go away, play against type and still move people. In fact, that song they didn't want to release when he was alive. They had no intention of releasing that because it was in a different genre. It was what Al Bell from Stax Records called the folk soul, which is a very difficult thing to do and almost never successful. But you could tell in Otis's voice at the time that he was very conflicted because he was coming off throat surgery, didn't know if he'd be able to sing like the old Otis, and he had to make this transition. And the song itself is a cry, is a plea to be left alone for a while, let him do his thing.
So one of the things that you talk about in your book is how Otis Redding was more than just a really successful performer and songwriter. But you say that he helped seed social change, that most of which occurred after his death. What do you mean?
Yeah, completely unwittingly, because Otis was not a political man. His songs were always apolitical. He never really wanted to express an opinion on that. Later in his life, he sort of started coming around toward that political bent. He was thinking of starting a union for black musicians and singers and so on and so forth. But his music was always rigorously apolitical. So he had to write about what he could write about. And that was the battlefield, basically, of his marriage and his love life, which was always a hellaciously ambivalent thing to him. I mean, he could go from writing a song like Chained and Bound about love to You're One and Only Man, which was, you know, completely opposite kind of feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, right, it was like, you know, how do you reconcile that? But Otis did, because it was always about...
Yeah, I love you,
tortured,
but you're keeping me in prison, right?
Yeah, it's just, and security and things like that. It was like, it was the battlefield of love. But in Otis's mind, he had to have love. He had that fear of abandonment, and he always wanted to have that loving aspect of his life.
Mark Hrabowski is author of the book Dreams to Remember, Otis Redding, Stax Records, and the Transformation of Southern Soul. It's available now. Coming up, an elite center for string players at Mercer University in Macon aims to give students a well-rounded education. Founder Robert McDuffie joins us to talk about what he calls the Juilliard of the South. But next, music legend Greg Allman tells us how the Allman Brothers got their start. This is On Second Thought.
Same for come and go. Yeah. The gypsy flies from coast to coast. Knowing many, loving none.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Occasionally, we ask people in the music industry to give us their two favorite songs written or performed by a Georgia artist. It's part of a series called the Georgia Playlist, and one of the most common picks that artists mention is the Allman Brothers.
My favorite song from Georgia artist is Melissa by the Allman Brothers. It really had that laid-back, jammy kind of thing going on that has kind of been a staple of Georgia music as far as I can remember.
I mean, they're legends of Southern music, and just, you know, writing from a Southern perspective or having a Southern style, it's a little bit hard to articulate, but those guys, you know, epitomized it, really. If it didn't have a specific influence on my style of writing, it was the kind of spirit of music that I really loved.
The band itself has often stood as an ambassador for Georgia, and one of the great symbolic emblems of the type of creativity that comes out of our state.
Those were the voices of Terry Chitwood from the band Dirt Messiah, Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls, and music journalist Doug LaRoche. Lots of people have talked about the Allman Brothers, and now we're pleased to hear from the man himself, Greg Allman. He spoke last year with Celeste Headlee shortly before being inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame. Celeste began the conversation by asking Greg to talk about Macon's influence on his storied career and how the Allman Brothers got their start.
I wanted to talk to you about your newest album, Back to Macon, Georgia, which is being released at about the same time that you're going to be inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame. And I wonder if you're at a period in your life when you're sort of looking back over your time in Macon and the beginnings of the Allman Brothers Band and tracing back to where your really distinctive style came from.
Well, as for Southern rock, all right. Now, this is an opinion. This is just the way I see it, okay? The way I look at it, there were four kings of rock and roll. Elvis, Aaron Presley, Tupelo, Mississippi. Jerry Lee Lewis, Faraday, Louisiana. Little Richard Penniman, Macon, Georgia. And the other one is... I think he's a little above the Mason-Dixon, but it'd be a Chuck Berry, St. Louis, Missouri. Those four were the first that came out with real rock and roll. Therefore, the rock and roll was born in the South. And saying Southern rock is just like saying rock. I mean, it's rock is Southern. So... me and my brother were raised, you know, career-wise, on rhythm and blues. I don't know how familiar you are with Daytona Beach, Florida, but at the end of Main Street, there's a big pier that goes out into the ocean. And there's a big, big house, or a big, big establishment, right about midway the pier. And that was a dance hall. They called it the Ocean Pier Casino. That right there is where me and my brother learned to play. And we got into a band that needed only one guitar player, so we would switch off every other night. And my brother was kind of a crooner. He came to me one day and he said, "Man, you need to learn to do something, or you know, you're gonna have to hit the bricks." I said, "Wait a minute." And this was now after the Ocean Pier, and by now we had started our first band called the Allman Joy. So it was me either learn to play keyboards, but mainly learn to sing, or I'm out, right? So I started singing, and I actually have tapes of about the third night, and they are atrocious.
Oh, man, I wish I could hear them.
Oh, no, nobody will ever hear these. No, I'm afraid to give them up because then they'll get all over the place, and I can't bear having to listen to that day to day.
I want to take you back to those days when you guys were recording in Macon, and I want to play you this comment from Phil Walden. He co-founded Capricorn Records, and he's talking about what a stir you guys made when you first arrived there. Take a listen.
And needless to say, it was sort of a social phenomenon for Macon when they first arrived. Long hair had not come in, and they had some of them shoulder-length hair or longer, and guys would really turn around in the street when they would see one of the Allman Brothers and their lifestyle. They rode around town on motorcycles, and they became rather well known.
Macon was a pretty small town when you guys were there. What was the reaction of the people of Macon when you guys showed up on motorcycles with long hair and making a really a different sounding kind of music?
Well, we got looks for everything from... wow, who are these guys to, whoa, there goes the neighborhood, you know? So, and everything in between, you understand? So we got a multitude of different ones. We never came to any harm because the real dad in the world rednecks, you know, one of these, hey, you want to dance? Oh, I thought you was a girl, you know,
yeah.
One of those. And nobody ever got severely hurt or anything. But we had a little time, but, you know, we stuck to our guns. I mean, that's the way we wanted to look. That's the way we wanted to live, and that's just the way it was. We figured, you know, we got to let these people know that we mean no harm. You know, kind of, I'm a lover, not a fighter. I'm a BMI songwriter. And so we would go and set up in the park on Sunday, and, I mean, nobody around. We'd set all our stuff up and just kick off, start playing.
Wow, really?
And, you know, within 2-3 hours, there was, you know, anywhere from 1,000 to just people, you know, wondering, what do we got coming from? What is this sound coming from the park? And, you know, the park was in kind of a valley, so the sound was just beautiful. And, I mean, beautiful quality. And that's when we first got together. And we started doing it every Sunday, Sunday. Because we were building up our repertoire so we could go and hit the road and hit some of these, you know, well, hit anywhere that would hire us or anywhere that would let us play for free. Like in 1970, we worked 306 nights and traveled the rest of them. So we didn't come back to Macon, back home, for a whole year that year.
Wow.
And when we did, of course, we went back to the park and played free. Then we went to Piedmont Park in Atlanta. Actually, I think we might have gone there first, because we got through with enough to play a show, and everybody looked around and said, you know, what the hell now? What are we going to play? Because we didn't play. We played original songs. We'd all had it with that. I mean, for 8 years, me and my brother went and played the Chitlin' Circuit, as they refer to it, which is all the old roadhouses around the southeast, you know, from Louisiana to Florida.
A year before your brother died, he spoke on WPLO radio. This is back in 1970 or so. And it sounds to me like he's trying to grapple with defining what rock and roll was. This is something that you talked about a little bit earlier and how it's different from the blues. And I wanted to play it for you and get your thoughts. Take a listen.
It's like a newspaper for people that can't read. Rock and roll will tell you right where everything's at, man. It's blues, but it's not like blues so much. It's like just something to move your feet, man, and move your heart and make you feel good inside, you know, fill up some of the dead space. Especially here in Atlanta, I know there's plenty of dead space with the police department and stuff here and all the crap that goes down, man. This, a lot of that stuff's really a drag. That's why we live in Macon instead up here, though, because it's not near as full of perverted people.
There's a couple things that I wondered if you'd touch on. I don't know if you agreed with him on that you guys lived in Macon because Atlanta was full of perverted people. But I wanted to go back to his description of rock and roll as something. He kind of describes it as something that's almost visceral, that you feel in your stomach and your feet rather than process through your head. And I wonder what you think about that.
It's true. It's true. I mean, when you, see the people that have, like, they don't make it there before the show starts. They come in the door, man, and as soon as they cross the threshold, their body starts moving, and a smile comes on their face. And it's the weekend. I got off. Me and my lady going dancing. Woo! And the bass slaps them in the chest. And, yeah, makes your feet happy. Makes your heart happy, makes you forget all your problems for ever how long we played. It'd be an hour and a half or 6 hours like we once did. If we weren't playing on a Sunday or something, we'd all go to the big house and all the ladies would prepare a big feast for us. And we all sit around and have what they call a guitar pull. In some of the early ones, I said, well, I got this song called Melissa, and
Oh, you know what? Would you tell me this? Tell us the story again. I love this story of how you came up with the name of the song. Because as I understand it, you wrote the whole thing and you didn't have the girl's name, right?
Right. She was somebody that I dreamed of and like the perfect woman that could be with me out on the road, you know. Because, you know, you get lonesome out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, one-nighters, they... you go through that phase, but it's very short-lived when it comes to my me going through it. And, you know, I just got to mean something, you know. Anyway, I had the whole song written, and I had back home, you'll always run to sweet Barbara, you know. sweet Christine, you know. I need three syllables. And so I just, you know, you work on it just so long and it gets redundant, you know, and the whole thing starts sounding like a bunch of noises. So I, this was back in 67. This is way before the Allman Brothers.
It's the first song you wrote, right?
Right. Well, I wrote and kept. I would write something like I'd stay up all night and slave over this tune. And I'd go and show it to my brother and say, all right, man, we're going to get out of these damn clubs. Check this out. I've got it. We got it. We got it not. So I'd play him the song, and he said, little bro, I don't really know how to break this to you in a nice way, but what you have here is a different set of lyrics to an album cut off the second Stones record. You know, I go, oh, no. And just subconsciously, you know, and this song was in my head, and, you know. And so he said, you need to get some new music for it, you know. And that was frustrating as hell. So Melissa was the first one that didn't go into the round file, the garbage. And I didn't even show it to anybody for about, you know, we didn't record it until after my brother passed away.
Oh, wow.
But it was like every time he'd have a few drinks, he'd say, Greg, go get your guitar and play me that song about the girl, you know, the gypsy, and, you know. And I'd play it for him and, you know, rock him to sleep with it.
So I wanted to ask you about the relationship between musicians and record labels. I know you had your own troubles with some of the record labels you worked with.
All.
How bad can it be, that relationship between a musician and a record label?
Well, I tell you, not naming any names, but it's all about American greed. You know, you got the big companies. They got 100, 200 different artists that are trying to get on their record label. So they kind of take the opinion that wasn't for us, you know. Boy, your music ain't never going to get heard. It was like they were running the show, you know, always. It used to be the same way with disc jockeys. Like, you know, it wasn't for me playing the records. You wouldn't have no record. And it was very frustrating. It was. Plus, they would they'd try to grab your publishing. And man, that ain't right. The writer of a song should always get paid. That's what's wrong with Spotify. You can print that or you can play that. I mean, it's free, man. You know, people, they stop at Starbucks and they buy them a $4.80 cup of coffee. And they drink it down, and it's gone. It's over. But they can't go $1 for a song that's going to last them the rest of their days. That just don't make sense to me. And why, though, there's an ingenious part of the whole makeup of Spotify, it's they don't even pay the writers. And that, to me, is just, it's just robbery, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we all have to make a living, right?
Yep.
But making records anymore is really kind of a joke. You know, I mean, it costs a lot of money to make a record. And the record company get theirs back first before you see a dime.
That was singer and songwriter Greg Allman speaking last year with my colleague Celeste Headley.
Crossroads, same will come and go.
Yeah. It's a classic Allman Brothers hit. We want to hear from you. What is your favorite Allman Brothers song? Let us know. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page. Coming up, we continue our exploration of Macon music. How is the city influencing the next generation of artists? This is On Second Thought.
Sweet Melissa.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. America was purportedly founded on the principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But for some of America's founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, they were also slave owners. On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk with Kenneth Davis about his new book, In the Shadow of Liberty, The Hidden History of Slavery, Four Presidents, and Five Black Lives. And we want to hear from you. How does the legacy of slavery taint America's history, or does it? Call us at 404-500-9457 to be a part of this discussion, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Well, as we've heard, Macon launched the careers of celebrated musicians like Greg Allman, Otis Redding. But Macon has also been home to many unsung musical heroes, and one tour company makes every effort to give them their due. Jamie Weatherford and Jessica Walden are a husband and wife team who run Rock Candy Tours in Macon. They offer guided visits of historical music sites in the city. They spoke with Celeste Headley in February as part of our Year of Georgia Music series. She began by asking Jamie who he considers the most underrated musician in Macon.
One of the ones that first pops in my mind, just in terms of the local scene, or somebody who had such a tremendous impact, would be Johnny Jenkins. Johnny Jenkins and Phil Walden, who is best known as the founder of Capricorn Records, had a career that was intertwined together forever. But Johnny Jenkins also played an instrumental role in launching the career of Otis Redding.
Let's actually hear from Johnny Jenkins.
Some people think they charm me, but I know they must be crazy. They can't see that misfortune, or if they're just a little too lazy.
So, Jamie, how did Johnny Jenkins help launch Otis Redding into fame?
Well, when Phil Walden first started what is known as Phil Walden Artist and Promotions in 1958, one of the first bands that he started booking was a band called Johnny Jenkins and the Pine Toppers. And in the background of this band, actually, as a backup singer, was Otis Redding. And it was through this relationship that Phil and Otis created that eventually Otis Redding would actually become a partner with Phil Walden in Phil Walden Artist and Promotions. And to our knowledge, that was the first integrated owned business in the city of Macon. Otis was 17 years old and Phil was 18 years old. And together, they would manage and book the careers of a lot of tremendous R&B artists out of Macon, Georgia, including Sam and Dave, Percy Sledge, Ike and Tina Turner, The Meters, Clarence Carter. They had a tremendous roster of great Southern soul artists. And, of course, Otis Redding himself would become the king of soul by 1967.
Normally, this would be where Jessica, where I'd say there's no relation between Jessica and Phil Walden, but that's not true.
All roads lead back to Macon, and for me, it comes back to a family tree. And my this is where the course of my family's history changed. My uncle Phil Walden was my father's older brother, and he fell madly in love with what was called Race Records at the time, and ultimately took the whole family with him into the music industry. And, of course, really shaking things up here in Macon, Georgia.
Did you ever have conversations about what it was he loved so much, what he heard? He seemed to have an incredible ear for talent.
He really did. It's something that I ask myself all the time. He just had this unbridled passion for music. I mean, he was just a fanatic about it. And when you look at how many, he just had that ability to spot talent. And it wasn't just in the artist. Of course, he had Otis Redding, and then lightning struck twice again with Duane Allman. But it was also in the what we've discovered with Rock Candy Tours and the music executives that he brought along, finding Frank Finner and sweet-talking him to come from the UK to Macon, Georgia, finding a guy who had an idea for an art concept on a T-shirt and basically started the music merchandise industry. Uncle Phil really did know how to spot him, and it really was his love for music that just kind of absorbed all these people and just created this music mecca in Macon.
Okay, so Jamie, to tell us about another musician who maybe doesn't have the headlines that, say, Duane Allman or Greg Allman or Otis Redding had.
Well, one that seems to be coming popular again is a gentleman named Emmett Miller, and Emmett was born in Macon. And was best known basically as a minstrel singer, which is sort of a connection between some of the vaudeville days and country music. And Emmett Miller, particularly his version of Lovesick Blues, was a tremendous inspiration to Hank Williams and Merle Haggard. And he seems to be receiving some recognition again now, sort of being remembered for his contribution to American music.
Well, let's take a listen. This is Lovesick Blues as recorded by Emmett Miller in 1928.
I'm in love with a beautiful gal, but she don't care about me. To make her love me, I tried, Lord, I was sad and I cried, but she just refused.
So now let's listen to Hank Williams' rendition of that same song.
I got a feeling of the blues. Since my baby said goodbye, Lord, I don't know what I'll do. All I do is sit and sigh, oh Lord.
Jessica, how did your family and others attract so many musicians to Macon, even those who were not born there?
That's another thing that, you know, every time we give a tour, we even have to step back and ask ourselves, what was it about Macon, Georgia? But I really do believe it was Phil's love for this town. He could have been anywhere. He could have been in Los Angeles. He could have been in the other M's, Muscle Shoals and Memphis. But he really did plant a flag in Macon. And, you know, there was this sleepy southern town that just seemed to inspire this great bit of creativity. People ask me all the time, you know, what is your favorite part of all this? And my favorite stories are the ones that involved rhythm and blues, because, I mean, they were doing great things together in the backdrop where black and white people weren't allowed to be together in public spaces, especially in the South. And they really had a fearless ability to still create, and that was their way of changing the social fabric, was through writing songs and recording together and bringing instruments together and then ultimately making people dance together. The Reddings and the Waldens, we are family to this day, and my dad and Otis bought properties adjacent to each other so they could be out in the country and ride horses and fish together. And, you know, that sense of kinship is just, it's lasted through time and tragedy.
So, Jamie, by the time we get to the 1980s, the music scene in Macon kind of fades out. What happened?
The new wave movement. Which is interesting because a lot of the new wave acts were booked by a subsidiary of Capricorn Records called Paragon Booking Agency. So a lot of the bands that you're familiar with, the Go-Go's, the Bangles, Debbie Harry, Iggy Pop, they were actually being booked out of Macon, Georgia. But Phil and Frank Finner of Capricorn Records just didn't really see much of a future in that. And Mike Mills and Bill Berry were not born in Macon, but these are half of the band REM. And together they kind of were trying to create a punk scene with Ian Copeland, who was a booking agent. And around 1979, the B-52s started finding success in Athens. And it was Mike Mills and Bill decided it was time to give another city a shot. And basically from 1979 to about 1982, that's when most of the infrastructure, the executive infrastructure of Macon began to leave. And that's basically when Athens started becoming Athens and Macon started becoming Macon. I would like to point out, though, that REM had a lot of help from Ian Copeland, who, of course, was from Macon, Georgia. And then Widespread Panic was founded and by Philip Walden Jr., Phil's son. So while Athens' two most successful early bands were having success, they were still being helped out tremendously by Macon. So I'm going to tell Athens they owe us a debt of gratitude.
Well, I think they hear you at this point. But Jessica, before we go, what about the structures? We've heard a lot about some of the endangered historical structures in Macon. Are they going to be preserved?
Yes, this is an exciting time in Macon, Georgia. We really began this tour company to tell the story of these places that we did feel like were endangered. The Capricorn Studio was listed by the Georgia Trust as one of the top 10 places in peril in 2010. And it was announced that the Capricorn Studio is going to be brought back to life. I think a lot of our future in Macon is going to stand well on the shadows of this legendary past and hopefully inspire some new talent along the way.
That's Jessica Walden and Jamie Weatherford. They run Rock Candy Tours in Macon. Celeste spoke with them in February as part of our year-long series, The Year of Georgia Music. Now to another side of Macon's music scene that is often overlooked, classical music. World-renowned violinist Robert McDuffie has brought a unique brand of music education to Macon. His McDuffie Center for Strings is what he likes to call the Juilliard of the South. It is housed at Mercer University, where I should say that I'm also on the faculty. As McDuffie Center students work on perfecting their musical abilities, they're also offered a full academic curriculum, along with advice on how to make a financially stable career out of music. McDuffie talked last year with Celeste about his vision for a music conservatory in Macon, and she began by asking the Juilliard-trained musician what he thinks about the Juilliard of the South label.
It's kind of truthful. I mean, we have some students who have been accepted into the Juilliard graduate program already, so I think we're in the same weight class.
What kind of degree do you earn at the McDuffie Center?
It's a Bachelor of Music. That's the official title of the degree. They get a comprehensive music education, especially on the string side, because it is a string conservatory. But we've altered the curriculum in order to prepare the complete independent contracting musician. We don't want our graduates to go out in the world and not know how to read a contract, not know how to raise money, not know how a nonprofit works. The landscape in classical music is shifting at almost daily pace. Our students will have a head start because of the curriculum they're receiving here at Mercer, and that includes the business of music, contract law, dispute resolution, public speaking. So it's not just fiddle players we're churning out here. We're actually preparing entrepreneurial musicians.
And this is the part that interested me, and it's the reason why I chose to go to a public university. I went to Northern Arizona University and the University of Michigan for my music degree rather than a conservatory because I wanted a more broad education.
Brilliant.
In other words, and this was the late 90s, but I recognized that the chances that I was going to be able to make my living entirely from music were slim. And I found that the conservatories weren't preparing you to be a secretary during the day.
Exactly. Well, when I came out of Juilliard in 81, I was a very ambitious player. I mean, I was determined to be a soloist, but I had a much greater margin for error. I mean, I could fail a lot at my quest of becoming a, you know, musician. Today, the elite high-level musicians who come out of not only conservatories but schools of music at universities kind of have one chance to make it. And we are very aware of that. And that's why our faculty, who are all visiting distinguished professors, they're all on the front lines of classical music, who come on a revolving door basis, bringing the real world to Macon. The classical music world is shifting towards a self-governing model where musicians will have to have the authority to determine their own destiny instead of depending on a, you know, just a nonprofit board and a management structure.
So let me ask you about another kind of intransigent problem in classical music, and that is diversity. After decades of trying, we seem in the classical music realm, we seem to still be having trouble getting players who are Black or Latino or other minorities. We seem to have trouble then including the works of minority composers in regular seasons. I'm not talking about, like, you know, Black History Month, but just a regular season program. How do you address that as a teacher, as leading a school? How do you bring more diverse faces into your lesson rooms?
Right. What you just brought up, to me, is the most crucial problem that we have in classical music. And I do think it's a matter of survival.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of community art schools in this country that cater towards minority and disenfranchised young people whose parents are so thirsty for these kids to learn. And the kids are wonderful. I was on the board of the Harlem School of the Arts for 10 years. I was able to see that. Two things are missing, in my opinion. One, the teaching, the quality of the teaching, and support from brand name conservatories to turn these community art schools into feeder schools for these famous conservatories. I love Juilliard. Juilliard taught me how to play the fiddle, but Juilliard's investing tens of millions of dollars in satellite conservatories in China instead of investing in their own town in the urban community art schools to oversee and even provide the instruction for the kids when you really need to get them and excite them. It's about the teaching and it's about the commitment. You can just throw so much money at these ideas. But a lot of these community art schools cater to parents and guilty white people. But I can't be talking about this, you know, be on my high horse unless I do something. It's going to take a while for all this to be realized. But if I'm going to go out there and tell my alma mater that they're not doing right by their community, I have to show that we're doing something at our school.
One last question for you, because you have been wanting to turn Bell House into conservatory for years. Why? What is it about Bell House?
Well, I'm from Macon. There are great bones in Macon. There are beautiful, beautiful antebellum structures here. This particular house, to me, was begging for music instead of being just a commercial building with lawyers, accountants, and herbal massage therapist. It's this very special place that these special kids can call home and be very proud of. And the beauty of the building is commensurate with the music we teach.
That's violinist Robert McDuffie. He's the founder of the McDuffie Center for Strings at Mercer University. Celeste Headley spoke with him last year. And that's it for our show today, but we want to hear from you. Who are your favorite Macon musicians? And why do you think the city has been and remains such a music hotspot? Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can post to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio as well. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley this week. Have a great day.